Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that to many sounds like science fiction. America's National Security Space Enterprise is at an inflection point. The way we operate on orbit, and by that I mean our force design and satellite architectures, are increasingly vulnerable to attack. They fly highly predictable paths and can be easily targeted by our adversaries, who have perfected technologies to shoot them down. Our satellites lack effective countermeasures and can only conduct limited slow maneuvers while in orbit. So think about it this way. It would be like if our fighter aircraft flew on fixed courses at constant speeds and lacked significant self-protection systems and, oh by the way, could only maneuver just a little bit. Talk about vulnerable, and that's why we have a problem in space. China and Russia are both deploying new anti-satellite weapons, we call these ASATs for short, to realize a rapid and destructive vision of space warfare. They know how dependent we are on our space enterprise for a broad range of capabilities, and they want to land a knockout punch. We need to respond to ensure we can get the job done on orbit even when we are under attack. That means maneuvering out of harm's way for both defensive and offensive purposes. If you're going to maneuver, you need energy. Ask any fighter pilot. We want tons of power on our jets. The same will hold true for maneuver warfare in space. Satellites will need reliable, enduring forms of propulsion that extends past the basic thrusters and limited propellant engines we have today. So that brings us to our discussion, an important solution when it comes to next-gen space propulsion. And I know it sounds like it's out of a science fiction film, but this technology is called Space Nuclear Propulsion, or SNP. It's a key part of the solution that is going to help us gain the advantage when it comes to maneuvering in space to preserve our long-held advantages. Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Studies at the Mitchell Institute's Space Power Advantage Center of Excellence, has spent the past few months digging into this challenge, not just to look at the problem, but to investigate where we need to go to deliver solutions.
Thanks for having me.
We're also very fortunate to be joined by some top-notch practitioners in the field, Dr. Ron Fabisch, Senior Director of Strategic Development at General Atomics Electromagnetic Systems Group.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Brandon Coach Davenport, former commander of 2nd Space Warning Squadron and U.S. Space Force Weapons Officer.
Hi, thank you for the chance to give my perspective.
As well joining us is Major Nathan Greiner, Program Manager of DARPA's Demonstration Rocket for Agile Cislunar Operations, or DRACO for short. And I'd just like to say welcome to everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, I want to get started with you first and congratulate you on the report. It's an important paper, and most of us have not really considered a lot of the detail that you've brought to us. So to kick this off, just want to give our listeners a brief overview of the paper.
Sure thing. So the title of the paper is Maneuver Warfare in Space, the Strategic Imperative for Nuclear Propulsion. And what it addresses is an issue that is not a long-term science fiction-y kind of crazy thought. This is a near-term and a mid-term problem that was facing us today. If you look back on the history of, like, the Chinese, for example, the Chinese have been progressing in the development of space weapon systems and operational capabilities since the 1970s, but even more in the early 90s forward. And so they have been sitting in rooms, kind of like we're sitting in now, having discussions about what they want to have at a certain point in time. And one of the things that they've based their military space forces development on is a concept they call mobile warfare. And mobile warfare in the Western world is typically referred to as maneuver warfare. And what that is essentially is, at the strategic level, because there's a tactical piece that most people are familiar with, at the strategic level, it consists of two parts. There's a psychological part and a physical part. The physical part is the more familiar aspect, where you have the ability to move and maneuver more rapidly than your adversary in either a combat situation or a pre-conflict situation where you're posturing your forces for advantage. And at the psychological level, it's where basically it's like Sun Tzu, where you get into the mind of your adversary and you try to defeat them before fighting actually commences. So you try to find a spot that will give you the best advantages over your adversary. So in the case of space, one of the key pieces of maneuver warfare thought is to exploit centers of gravity. And what that means is essentially, in the maneuver warfare side of things, is looking for the critical vulnerability that is the underlying foundation of terrestrial advantage. So our conventional forces have been pretty much considered to be one of the best in the world, if not the best in the world, for several decades. And so how does a rising power like the Chinese have a way to defeat us in a future conflict? And the best way to do that without having to build a massive military, which they're doing that too, but is to maneuver around the conventional advantage of the terrestrial force that's enabled by space. So space infrastructure is what they view as our soft ribs or our key vulnerability that is to be exploited. And if you hit that hard and fast on what we would call pre-conflict situations, but they would call it active deterrent activity, then they have the ability to defeat us in a conflict by taking out key areas of our space infrastructure. So that's what we talk about in the paper. And basically, one of that also, I'll mention that they're doing that now with their current kinetic interceptors, lasers, and other things through what they call multi-layered attack architecture. But by 2040, as open source reporting is indicating, they're looking at enhancing that maneuver advantage over us in space through nuclear thermal propulsion vehicles. In fact, they use the word fleets to articulate what kind of capability size and force size that they want by 2040, which isn't too far from now, given we're already in 2022. So with their ability to keep their plans on track as they typically have been, slow and methodical, they'll probably have something operational in the 2030s. So that's what the paper is about in general, and we argue for several things that we'll discuss throughout the podcast today.
Well, Chris, I really do appreciate the overview, and I know we're going to get into the weeds, and I want to bring Coach in here. Coach is a former space weapons officer and former commander in the Space Force, and I know, Coach, you've seen quite a few things happen in space that most of us will never know about due to classification. So if you can just tell us all those things right now, that would be great. I'm kidding. We're gonna stay unclassified here. But in all seriousness, as an operator, I know you can tell us from your perspective how important it is to have the maneuver advantage in space.
Absolutely. From my point of view, my opinion, it is incredibly important. Pretty much every, even in a benign environment, spacecraft operators are always considering the usable fuel life remaining on their satellite for any type of maneuver. Historically, that has meant station keeping and disposal, right, as our primary considerations. And now as you add this additional layer of having to be able to thwart or defeat attacks, you just recognize how, again, my opinion, the Defender is inherently at a disadvantage. It is somewhat hard to hide ourselves in orbit, and those orbits are chosen for usually for a particular purpose, whether it's communication or missile warning or navigation. And by virtue of that, I need those satellites to maintain that orbit for a long period of time. An adversary just needs to come up and spoof us or push us off of that orbit for a short period of time during a conflict. And so it's just much more difficult to defend against a running attack like that if you are always looking at your fuel reserves. And so in this current situation, it's a significant advantage or disadvantage based on how much fuel you have.
Yeah, and it's funny, talking to Chris and others in the space world, when you think about how a lot of these satellites were put in orbit in a different era, right? We were never really thinking about these satellites having to defend themselves or to have a lot of maneuverability. So they went up with a fixed amount of fuel. And to your point, it was more like a station keeping type of scenario just to stay in the proper orbit. So can you walk us through why the current propulsion options fall short of meeting demand, given that, what you just talked about? Is the conventional chemical propellant designs really a limiting factor for our legacy constellations when we're addressing these defensive matters?
Yes, Slick, absolutely. Just as you mentioned, these systems were designed inherently the early 2000s in a benign environment. But even if you were to redesign the systems today, you are still going to be constrained by launch weight, right? So most satellite designers, you're fighting size, weight, and power. And the payload is the primary reason you're going up there, right? So if you have a satellite that's built to communicate, you're going to have these transponders that are there, and you can't really design around that too much. Therefore, your requirements are going to be based off of the mission requirements. And so to defend against an attack is important, but it's only as important as the payload that you're defending. And so chemical propulsion is really constrained by the physics of that reality, right? We have to launch up a certain amount of payload, a certain amount of weight to batteries, a certain amount of weight to solar panels. And then anything at excess, you're probably going to put into fuel reserves. And you can't really just scale that up without making it much more complex. And so you really just caught on a limitation, you know, a physical limitation based on chemical rockets. So it's not just something you can just gas it up, put a bigger gas tank. It's not a feasible solution.
So Nate, you're the program manager for DARPA's demonstration rocket for Agile Cislunar Operations, or DRACO, which is developing a nuclear thermal propelled spacecraft. So for starters, what's the background and context for this program, and why are you pursuing it now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think some of that needs a little bit of explaining as well for on DARPA's side, right? And some of that is that DARPA really operates in a unique area in the DoD, right? We operate in an area where we are taking ideas and turning them into realities for Department of Defense missions. And really in this role, there's a certain kind of Goldilocks zone of technologies that DARPA pursues. Really ideas that aren't so far out so as to be, you know, unrealistic, but not so near term that the service could just go off and acquire these technologies immediately as part of a program of record. So what we're doing under the DRACO program with pursuing nuclear thermal propulsion, this really lives within that Goldilocks zone. So back in the 1960s, there was a program called the Rover Nerva program, where they went off and demonstrated and tested 22 of these nuclear thermal propulsion reactors on the ground that really provided us the proof that shows that this technology is real. However, the program really ended before they got to a capability of actually flying these systems on orbit. Additionally, as Coach discussed, we now realistically are living in a world that has space being a warfighting domain, which is not something that was the same in the 1960s, right? Back in the 1960s, and really since then up until, you know, recent years, space has really been kind of a quiescent environment where we're using space to help support ourselves in other domains. But really, you know, when you listen to, you know, folks like General Raymond speak, space really has become a warfighting domain. And so really the confluence of those two things, right, showing that the technology is real, via like the programs in the 1960s with the Rover Nerva program, and the fact that, you know, today is now it's a warfighting domain, really the confluence of those two things is really what's pushing us towards, you know, developing like an advanced propulsion system like nuclear thermal propulsion. So that's really where the DRACO program comes in for this new environment. And really the objective of this program is to design an NTP engine, fabricate it, integrate it into a spacecraft, and launch it to above low Earth orbit, and demonstrate that technology on orbit in about the 2025 timeframe. And realistically, the ultimate goal of this demonstration is to provide an existence proof that this technology is real, and that not only is it real in the sense that we can go and ground test it, but it's real that we can actually put this technology on orbit and be able to do that on-orbit demonstration so that we can show that we can actually operationalize this capability to provide the United States that maneuver advantage that we need to operate in this space warfighting domain.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And the big question is, if your efforts are successful, do you see this providing the kind of capability that Chris and Coach both mentioned earlier?
So from what was discussed previously, right, there's being able to do maneuver takes energy, right? Doesn't matter if you're in space, in air, on the ground, you know, in the water. It really takes energy, right? So existing propulsion technology like electric propulsion allows you to deliver energy for maneuver with high efficiency for space maneuvers, but very slowly, right? Because you're doing it with very low thrust. When you compare that to the other dominant existing propulsion system, which is chemical propulsion allows you to deliver energy quickly through high thrust, but with very low efficiency. So nuclear thermal propulsion really is the marrying of those two worlds, the best of those two worlds, where you can get reasonably high efficiency for your propulsion with very high thrust. What that allows you to do is to do very big maneuvers quickly, to be able to deliver that energy quickly, to be able to deliver sizable amounts of energy to do large maneuvers. And realistically, for the DRACO program, we're not really focused on any one mission in particular, right? We've kind of scanned the environment and said, okay, we think that there are many different things that we can do. And we definitely think that we can enable, some of the capabilities that, were discussed previously. But really, our focus is on developing the actual engine itself. But absolutely, we see that capability to go off and demonstrate those new capabilities.
Yeah, no, I do appreciate that. And Dr. Fabish, as someone who's worked with nuclear technology at General Atomics for a while, where does this stand in, you know, as a tech readiness level, if you can bring us up to speed on that? As we understand it, you know, we've tested some of these systems before, and I think many of these concepts go back to the 1950s and 60s, but we've never flown one, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Thanks for the question, John. So as was mentioned before, I just want to make a comment that the need for this specific technology is well established. And some critical elements of our national security are here at stake. And industry stands ready to support the defense complex in anything that we can do to advance that cause. We need to find those solutions. The question is a very good one. In the 1950s and 60s, we have developed the first nuclear rocket, nuclear thermal propulsion rocket. It was tested and demonstrated on the ground and has achieved the technology readiness level of 6, believe it or not. That means that it was demonstrated at ground level, but was never tested in space or never flown to space. So that is true. It was hailed a success at that time, but there were some vital technology challenges still remaining before you could have launched it into space. And then the program was terminated this was in the Nixon era in the early 70s. But this is the ebb and flow type of development that this technology has suffered from over the years. And it was left at that point. Now, 50, 60 years since then, you can imagine we have made tremendous progress in materials, advanced fuels, nuclear fuels, and safety approaches to this type of missions and technologies. And we are at a point where we're very ripe at implementing these. The technology readiness level of the more advanced technologies obviously has to ripen to the level 6 and above. And we are doing it as we speak for example, General Atomics as being the performer under the DARPA DRACO program to develop this nuclear thermal propulsion systems as we speak. And I think the ambitious plan to have this demonstrated in flight by the 2025 or mid-2020s time range is very achievable and doable. We have learned a lot over the past 50 to 60 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, I see this obviously as it begins to enter the marketplace, if you will, for lack of a better way of saying it. It's obviously going to integrate or coexist with other propulsion systems that are out there, like electric propulsion or even options to refuel the chemical-based propulsions that on systems that are already in orbit. So can you talk to us about the unique advantages afforded by SNP and how you see it kind of phasing into operational use?
Absolutely. So the focus of this discussion is obviously nuclear thermal propulsion, which is basically flowing hydrogen, the propellant, through a nuclear reactor to create high thrust. What we're interested in is high thrust and high efficiency of the propellant use. That's this so-called specific impulse that we have, the ISP, so-called ISP of the system. We are seeking to optimize that and maximize on thrust. That's what will enable the quick maneuverability that is needed for this type of systems and the missions at hand. Only nuclear thermal propulsion can offer that, basically. If you look at other technologies, they are promising for various missions of both commercial and defense. However, if you look at the mission at hand and the reasons that we need this technology for, this affords us the capabilities that others simply do not. Let's say chemical propulsion, for example, the obvious conventional alternative that was already mentioned before, it offers a thrust that is a factor of 2 smaller than that of NTP. And you can imagine you have to carry much more propellant because of the efficiency of the burn with chemical propulsion than with nuclear thermal propulsion. The technology is here. Other in-space technology have their role, and I think we're going to see those developed over the next 5 to 10 years to maturation. But we have a critical mission in hand, and nuclear thermal propulsion can answer the call for that mission. You know, one thing I wanted to mention is the fact that these nuclear thermal propulsion systems, the fact that we have a nuclear reactor providing propulsion power or ability to propel, it can also provide power itself to any system on the spacecraft or satellite or whatever that might be. So that means the payload. So a bimodal system, we call it, where nuclear can take care of those two things in at the same time is very attractive, I think, to the military. And I think it is a no-brainer, actually, that you want to have both propulsion and power available on that system that you're going to be deploying.
Well, sir, I want to keep going on this topic, and I'm sure you've had to address this with critics or for folks that just don't really understand. But when you hear the idea of, you know, something nuclear going into space, you know, the concept of a reactor going critical or radiation hazard probably have people really concerned. So can you talk to us about the safety of the technology and, you know, how effective it is for DoD missions or even commercial missions, as you mentioned?
So let me start by saying this is an excellent question, and I expected this question from anybody who is interested in nuclear and its applications or is concerned about it. Let's put it this way. Industry that is in the nuclear business, especially industry like player like General Atomics and I'm sure others, what we are saying always that we are, in terms of nuclear technologies, we're going to be delivering safe, robust, scalable nuclear propulsion systems on orbit on time. When I say safe, I put that as the first word in delivering those systems. It's very important for us to convince the public and the defense complex and the people who are going to be using this, that this is a safe technology that is being designed for safety. Performance is obviously really, really important, but we're not going to, you know, compromise on safety. So let's start by saying that when you launch this, this is not an operational reactor. This reactor is shut down. What we are using is chemical propulsion actually to reach orbit. And then this upper stage or whatever spacecraft we're going to put on top of this rocket, that is the element that is going to have an active nuclear hot reactor. And that's always going to be in space. So we are mitigating a lot of the initial risk to begin with. There's all kinds of abnormal conditions during launch that we are designing to. If there is a failure in the launch, if there is a fallback of the reactor, that reactor system is designed to withstand to the highest possible probability of no critical accident happening on Earth. So we have to make that a guarantee before this thing goes up.
If I could jump in for a second, the launch approval process has actually been a major enabling factor for this program. Back in August of 2019, a new presidential memorandum, NSPM 20, was published that actually revised our launch approval process for launching nuclear systems into orbit, both radioisotope thermal generators as well as nuclear reactor systems such as the DRACO system. And what this new system did was actually set objective safety thresholds for launch approval, whereas the previous launch approval process was really kind of a very qualitative, it needs to be safe enough kind of process. But with the new NSPM 20, with these objective thresholds, we now have, you know, very clear-cut guidance on what safety metrics we need to be able to actually meet. And as part of this presidential memorandum, what they did is they broke this out and said, okay, for fission reactors, if you are using highly enriched uranium, the launch approval authority for that launch will actually be at the presidential level, but that if you use low enriched uranium, that approval is actually delegated down to the head of the agency, which in the case of the DRACO program is the Secretary of Defense. And so to streamline that process, to utilize that advantage of being able to go to the Secretary of Defense for launch approval, the DRACO program has elected to utilize low enriched uranium for this program, which will really help to kind of streamline that overall launch approval process.
And Nate, I really do appreciate the clarification there, because I know a lot of our listeners will be honing in on this technology because of what it brings to the fight. So with the streamlining of the process for launching the nuclear-powered or nuclear-propelled spacecraft into space, how soon after a demonstration do you think the Space Force could operationalize this capability into a program of record?
Sure. Well, that certainly depends on the motivation level from the Space Force side, right? So there definitely are some additional challenges. So if you wanted to take this capability forward and operationalize it, there really are a couple different arms, right, of technology that need to actually be worked, right? we like to say at DARPA that at DARPA, we work on one miracle at a time, right? So the miracle that we're working on right now is the nuclear thermal propulsion miracle, right? That's the technology that we're looking to realize. So with that, there would certainly be some development needed after the DRACO program to go off and make an operational nuclear thermal rocket. But the intent is that at the end of the DRACO program, that we will, the putting distance from the end of DRACO to an operational rocket engine would be relatively short and achievable to be able to do that, right? Maybe one or two systems of generations between that and an actual operational system. But there are a couple of other, key technologies that would need to be realized to make this into an operational capability. One of those is the payload itself, right? And to some degree, that is largely on Space Force to do that, simply because they need to decide what is the mission that they actually want to use this propulsion for, as well as, technology they want to bring to bear to actually achieve that mission in the actual spacecraft payload. So that's one piece. Another really big piece here, though, is the propellant storage itself. So one of the major life-limiting factors, probably the major life-limiting factor of nuclear thermal propulsion is the propellant, right? And so in the case of DRACO, we're looking to utilize hydrogen propellant simply because when you're trying to get maximum efficiency, what you want to do is have a propellant with the smallest molecular weight possible, and it doesn't get any smaller than hydrogen, with the highest temperature possible, which is why we're using a nuclear reactor to get the temperature up as high as we can, which is great from a propulsion efficiency standpoint. But what's difficult about that is that hydrogen does not like to be liquid. It does not like to be stored in small areas. And so to do that, you have to be able to keep that hydrogen propellant at a cryogenic temperature, about 20 Kelvin, which, when you think of space, you think of space being fairly cold, right? But realistically, when you have, the sun shining on your system, really realistically, you get, about room temperatures in space. And so actually keeping the propellant at cryogenic temperatures can be very difficult. And so that is something that NASA has been investing in to a very large degree over the last, number of years. And so there is a parallel development path with the DRACO program, also on the NASA side with developing cryogenic fluid management. And so really that's one of the coolest things to me about the DRACO program, and one of the real advantages that we have is that this really is a cross-governmental approach to actually developing this operational capability, where DARPA is taking the lead on doing this flight demonstration. We're also leveraging expertise from NASA on the nuclear thermal propulsion side, as well as with cryogenic fluid management. And so there's really kind of a number of prongs here. But in terms of actually realizing an operational capability and when that timeline could actually close, really that's something probably more for our Space Force brethren to comment on there.
Yeah, one thing that we say often here on the Aerospace Advantage podcast is the fact that the enemy has a vote, right? So how does this really fit into a timeline poised by Russian and Chinese threats?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we've thought about a lot with this program as we were getting this program kicked off was, when you kind of think back to the discussion on chemical and electric propulsion and kind of the comparison between those two, right now, all sides of the fight are operating with the same types of propulsion. We all have electric propulsion. We all have chemical propulsion. And so in doing so, we're constantly playing these cat and mouse games, right? You create the aircraft, then you create a bigger aircraft, then you create, surface-to-air missiles, then you create, an anti-radiation missile. So it's always this kind of cat and mouse game, kind of using air as an analogy. And so when we talk about developmental timelines for systems that are being developed today, a lot of that is looked at through the lens of playing this cat and mouse game of how can I get the cat out for their mouse before they develop a cat for my cat, if you will. But realistically, when you think about nuclear thermal propulsion, there's such a leap ahead advantage here, right? That when this system actually gets fielded, it's not really a matter of timelines anymore, because now I'm in a situation where I'm completely enveloping their capability. It's almost, going back to the air-to-air analogy, it's almost like, we're working with Hindenburgs right now, and we're always trying to make a better Hindenburg. We're always trying to make a better dirigible. But with NTP, now that's going off and making the P-51 Mustang, right? And that is such an enveloping capability. It doesn't matter what you do with it on the dirigible side. I've now completely enveloped the capability for existing propulsion technologies. And so the timeline really is, it is important, especially because, you know, our adversaries certainly do get a vote in terms of what technologies they go off and pursue. But this technology, you know, if it was developed on the United States side alone, right, and quickly enough, right, that capability would be so enveloping that really the timelines of this kind of cat and mouse game kind of go by the wayside to a large degree.
Yeah, no, that's a great analogy, and I do appreciate it. So I want to go over to Coach and Chris for a little bit as the two operators in the room. What are the advantages that we're talking about here that could be seen by a capability like this versus our current legacy constructs based on, you know, limited maneuver and chemical propellant? Is this idea really decisive, and is it really going to make that big of a difference for us?
To me, it is game changing. In my time in command, any type of maneuver, the very first question I would ask is, okay, show me the fuel reserves, right? Whether it's an exercise, war game, or real world. And so, you know, most operators, again, it's on the front of our mind. These systems have typically lasted decades on orbit. It's a big cost over the lifespan of a satellite to maneuver it against that fixed fuel reserve. So in a case where I don't have that constraint anymore, now it's a different argument completely, whether or not I'm able to maneuver to maintain the system. And now I'm looking more at what's the impact to the warfighter, what's the impact to the adversary, you know, what's my probability that I'm going to defeat that attack. You know, it's much more tactical and operational questions I'm asking, not strategic, have I cost the satellite from the constellation, right? So from my view, I'm able to act as a tactical warfighter now, where before I had to look at the entire breadth of strategic to tactical decisions as I made a maneuver choice.
Yeah, and I'll just add also, one of the things that we noticed from research is that the Chinese have a view of space warfighting in their own writings as, quote, rapid and destructive. That's where they pretty much think that will be inevitable. So with their current systems of their kinetic interceptors, lasers, electronic warfare assets and stuff that they're using to maneuver strategically around our conventional advantages, it's very difficult, as we were talking about earlier, to decide, do we want to maneuver the satellite out of the way of the threat if we have obviously enough indications and warning, or do we want to just take the risk, keep it on mission, and see what happens? When you're looking at what the Chinese are planning on doing to exploit the vulnerability of this situation, is from a defensive standpoint, nuclear thermal would give us the ability to maneuver defensively a lot more often as necessary in a more dynamic environment than we're probably used to, than chemical propulsion would be. As we mentioned, with the limited fuel supply and the weight and everything, it's just not designed for that kind of activity. When you have a nuclear thermal propulsion, also from an offensive standpoint, you're able to get to wherever you need to go in various orbits, whether it's an orbital transfer around the Earth, or as the DRACO program's name implies, cislunar, with a lot of activity picking up out in space, out in cislunar on the far side at Lagrange points, which is like a gravity well where people can orbit around this point in space and have a view of both Earth and the Moon. A lot of stuff is going on commercially and technically from a geopolitical standpoint. And so you want to have the ability to get out to the Moon within hours instead of days and do that a couple different times on one tank of hydrogen. Where you can't do that with chemical propulsion. So you have the ability to maneuver between orbits in a matter of hours and out to the Moon in a matter of hours and stuff like that. So it'll be game-changing from a time standpoint to get out to wherever we need operational capability at a time and place of our choosing.
Yeah, it really makes sense to me. I guess the only question I have for you, Chris, is why haven't we deployed such capability before or tested it out in space yet?
Well, As we heard from Dr. Fabisch, it was tested up to TRL 6, and then they were getting ready and certifying it to go up into space in the early 70s. But most of the reasons why it got canceled, and then it came back up again and during the Strategic Defense Initiative timeframe of the 80s, and now DRACO is up and about. The reason why they were canceled is primarily due to policy reasons and budgetary restraints. Because like in the early 70s, that's the period of detente, where we were trying to lessen tensions with the Soviet Union at the time. And as a result of winning the space race and all that, they didn't see a need to go out to Mars or to have quicker response because we were pretty close to Earth still. So the space shuttle and having, you know, heavy lift capability to build things and moving, you know, NRO assets and other space vehicles in the space more routinely was more of a priority. And then with the end of the Cold War in the early 90s, that kind of ended the idea of the Strategic Defense Initiative using this kind of rapid response capability for space defense and missile defense. But now that we're seeing ourselves back into a great power competition type of situation after a 20-25 year period of you know, a hiatus and that kind of an activity, now we're having to deal with this now. This is an issue that's a now problem. We're dealing with threats that happen on a regular basis on the lower threshold, like jammers and lasers, and then we're also seeing, you know, ASAT tests from the Russians and the Chinese happen fairly frequently. So with that and their push for nuclear thermal propulsion, which we were the leaders in technologically, we got the technology. It's just a matter of getting the extra parts that were mentioned before up and running and tested. And once we get that done, there's really no reason other than a policy reason to not do this.
Yeah, and I know Dr. Fabisch has some points to make as well.
Yeah, I would just add that there's also quite a bit of alignment these days between commercial and defense needs. I think nuclear thermal propulsion can also, you know, is seen as an enabler for a lot of the missions that are needed right now, you know, in the commercial space. So there is this sense that we can leverage multiple mission needs right now that the United States needs. And it's an opportunity. The momentum is here to answer many calls to fulfill some of these mission needs, both critically on the defense side, but also on the commercial side of space exploration, deep space transport, and other needs, for example, that an agency like NASA has in space. So I think, no pun intended, the stars are aligned to make some of these things a reality.
Well, and I appreciate that. And Chris, I know you have some examples, and you spoke about policy, and I know you have examples of where DoD leaders can help move the Space Force and the DoD in the right direction, preparing for winning and in an environment where maneuver warfare in space is going to be so critical. So can you run through a couple of those and tell us what it's going to take to get SMP from a talking point to an operational capability?
Yeah, so I'll just say, as we kind of started from the beginning, we're behind from a standpoint of space deterrence and warfighting capabilities for the Space Force. The Space Force really has been looking at this for over 20 years, and we just haven't really done much with it. So what we recommended in the report is 6 recommendations. The first one is that we do need to adopt a new U.S. Space Force design capable of decisive maneuver warfare advantage in space. So without the ability to rapidly maneuver, whether it's a disaggregated or proliferated LEO or more legacy monolithic constellations, will just become and continue to be targets for the Chinese and Russian kinetic and non-kinetic counter-space weapon systems. Number 2 is we should field space nuclear propulsion as a means to deter and defeat threats through the ability to defend ourselves actively, as well as to provide the ability for offensive options at a time and place of our choosing in space. The third one would be that in order to do this, obviously this requires funding, it requires resources to operationalize something like DARPA's DRACO. So we recommend that if the testing is going to happen sometime around FY25, that we should begin in FY24 to start getting the budgetary process moving, because it usually takes 2 to 3 years to get a budget line going for a program of record. So beginning in FY24, start the allocation of resources to move the program from S&T development to a full acquisition program, just in case it's ready to go. And this will help the DoD operationalize a maneuver warfare-based force design before America's strategic competitors in the late 2030s, early 2040s. But until then, number 4, until that occurs, we really need to have some hedges to deal with the threat that we're currently facing now. Again, it's not a future threat, it's a current threat. So one of those to help us against kinetic ASAT weapons and stuff is to deploy a mission extension vehicle on GPS or any other critical infrastructure type satellite. So what mission extension vehicle is, it's a satellite system that's been deployed and tested on, I believe, some Intelsat satellites, where a propulsion packet goes into orbit, it rendezvous and docks with a satellite, and instead of using its onboard propellant for maneuverability, it uses the propulsion pack that docked with it and that can be used for orbital adjustments, and it can be used for emergency burns as well. But again, unlike nuclear thermal propulsion, it's not that rapid. It just provides some way to maintain some of the propellant load in case of a need of emergency maneuvers. Another one is that we should deploy our own ASAT weapon systems in the near term using current programs of record, both kinetic and non-kinetic. So that can include standard missile threes or ground-based mid-course interceptor missiles, for example, that can reach low MEO or medium Earth orbit at the very least, according to some open source information, and any other things. That way, while we're working toward on-orbit warfare capabilities, this can provide us some options in the near term to hold Chinese and Russian targets at risk. Because if you look at the way the Chinese and Russians think about space deterrence and warfighting, they don't really respond well to the threat of other domains, because there really hasn't been a whole lot of historical precedent for that. And they believe that in order to deter an adversary actively by attacking first, that they need to be able to hold space assets at risk. And the same applies to our adversary. So we should do that as well. And then finally, in order to get the public understanding this, including the representatives in Congress, it's very important that they improve their education and advocacy efforts on the growing threat to U.S. space systems and put it in more detail than just there's a threat to our space systems and they want to deny and degrade. Be more specific that can tell them about what a core orbital weapon is, what a direct descent missile is, what a high-powered laser does, what hacking can do, and what a highly maneuverable nuclear thermal propelled space weapon system could do to our infrastructure in space around the Earth and potential commercial applications in cislunar space. So there's much that needs to be done, but that's what could be done in the near term to get things going on the right track.
Yeah, thanks for that list. I really do appreciate it. I'm sure the audience is really going to enjoy picking those things apart. Final question for everybody involved here is, I'm not going to ask what we normally would ask in the DC Beltway is, you know, how much is this going to cost? But what I do want to hear from all of you is, looking at it a different way, what is the price of inaction when it comes to these recommendations and pursuing S&P at large? So, Dr. Fabish, we'll get started with you.
Well, I would obviously defer to the defense experts here to talk about the price of inaction. But I think I would look at it, I would put a twist on this, actually, thinking about it now after hearing everybody speaking. Why won't we act now? We have the knowledge. We have the experience. We were the leaders. We have been the leaders. We are falling behind. And we can do this. We can make it happen. We are doing it. We just need to sustain this effort. We need to make sure that we reach the finish line. And the price of inaction, as everybody said, is falling behind to entities such as China, such as Russia, and other adversaries that are gaining grounds on us. And as industry, we can do this here, made in the USA, and we can make it happen and help our defense complex and beyond to reach those goals. So we stand ready to support any way we can to make this a reality.
I guess my ad would be, I think the inaction will result in us being still stuck in the Sophie's choice between mission and long-term mission and short-term mission, pending any large-scale changes to our architecture, which I know there have been discussions also along that lines. But in some cases, the orbits that we do use are the most efficient orbit for the type of mission we're attempting to accomplish. And therefore, without either a system like this, again, we'll be stuck in that current rock in a hard place.
One last thing I'd like to be able to say, right, is, you know, we if we want to kind of learn a lesson for the future, you know, look to the past and to some degree even look to the present right now, right? Right now, we are in an arms race for hypersonics, right? If you look back in, you know, 2004 or 2010, where we were making investments in hypersonics, we were working towards that advantage, and we worked ourselves all the way up to doing the X-51 program, where we flew a scramjet and we met the hypersonic conditions. And on that day, we said, "Yep, yay, verily, hypersonics is a real technology." And then, to a large degree, our investments in hypersonics tailed off, right? But as history shows us, after that day, investments in hypersonics really ramped up to a very large degree on both the Chinese and Russian sides. And now we're finding ourselves in a position where we're playing this massive game of catch up where, you know, had we had this continuous investment since, you know, 2004, 2010, we wouldn't necessarily be in this same position, right? And that's really where we find ourselves today in the space world. you know, specifically looking at the propulsion problem, there really is a unique opportunity here to invest in a technology that really is going to be enveloping for the futures in a similar way to how hypersonics is so important to kind of the way we envision operations in the future for the land, sea, and air domains. And so when I think about the cost of inaction, I look to the past, I look to the present for where we are with hypersonics and say, you know, that's one example that really is looking at very conventional ways of operating. But just the level of importance that we put on space today, from my perspective, I don't think we can really afford not to continuously invest in this technology just because of how important, you know, we see it's going to be for future space operations. We certainly do not want to find ourselves in the same place, you know, 10, 15 years from now in space that we do right now in the hypersonics realm.
Yeah, and I'll just wrap up with an analogy from American military history that is mentioned in the paper, and that is when we were flying bombing missions over Hanoi in the Vietnam War, we used B-52s, which were at the time pretty much the most advanced bomber we had. But we kept flying over Hanoi at the same altitude, at the same vector, in a predictable fashion, to where they were able to shoot down 12 to 15 of those B-52s. And essentially they were sitting ducks because they knew how we were going to fly, what altitude, and they were able to aim their weapons at them. The same is kind of this is in space, whether it's a proliferated LEO constellation with more satellites that they would have to target, or whether it's the more legacy, monolithic, larger satellite systems. As Coach was saying, these orbits are designed for their specific missions, and the get-off mission by maneuvering is just going to keep us in these predictable orbits. It's not going to help us. So we need to have a force structure, and it doesn't have to be every satellite constellation doesn't have to have nuclear thermal in it, but we need to be taking a hard look at which ones are really critical infrastructure, like GPS, which the Russians have threatened to destroy every single one of them, which most people that I've worked with over the last 20 years of doing space stuff have thought was unlikely and infeasible. But with their ability to build fairly cheap missiles and lasers and things, they're definitely willing to do that. And having political will and the ability to do such is key to deterring an adversary from engaging and interfering in what they want to do. So I think that, as people have said, the price of inaction is keeping our current critical infrastructure in space at risk in these predictable orbits that, while great for a benign environment, aren't really good for a dynamic and warfighting environment.
Well, Dr. Fabers, thank you so much for chatting with us today. Really, really learned a lot from the discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. Like I said, we're ready, able, and excited to get going. We're already going on this to finish up and deliver these very important technologies to the military and to the wider community. This is really important, and I hope that this effort is going to be a sustained one to completion.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. And Coach, thanks so much for taking time out from being at school. Really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I think it's phenomenal that we have a place to start having these types of discussions as Space Force continues down the path as a new service. I think a dialogue and discussion about topics like these are really vital to explain to our nation why and how the service needs to be prepared to defend the country in a potential conflict in the future. So thank you for having us.
Nate, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. There's nothing DARPA program managers like to do more than talk about their program. So I certainly appreciate the opportunity to discuss the DRACO program, and certainly look forward to more good things to come.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate having you here. And Chris, great job with the paper. And also, thanks for getting such a great panel together to have this discussion.
No problem. I really appreciate it. And I'm thankful to everybody who came out. And I look forward to seeing, as Dr. Fabers said, seeing this become a reality shortly.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support. And thank you for tuning in today. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, and this year, we're headed out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. Also, leave us a comment to let us know what you think about our podcast and let us know areas you think we should explore further.
please visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to read the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.